So last fall, I took a really big risk. Some of you know of this risk. I brought this guy home to my wife without telling her about it. Okay, so it really wasn't that big of a risk. Cassie absolutely loves dogs. And we had been talking about getting a dog for a little while, kind of off and on, ever since we had moved to Minnesota. But the conversations weren't all that serious. We hadn't actually started looking at specific dogs or anything else like that. And I happened to mention to a friend last fall that we were at least talking about getting a dog at some point in time. And a few days later, I got a call at the office. And that friend was on the other line saying, so how serious are you actually about wanting to get a dog sooner or later? And a week later, Teddy came home with me. He's amazing. I love Teddy, at least most days I love Teddy. He is a 2-year-old yellow lab. Some of you have met him before. He is full of energy, full of excitement, and he will try to sucker you into doing just about anything for him. He has really, really big puppy eyes. And most of the time, he's a fairly well-behaved dog, but occasionally, like most 2-year-old dogs do, specifically labs, he gets what we call puppified. And that is, he gets so excited, he gets so anxious, he gets so happy that he just cannot control himself. There's like no containment to anything he can do. And sometimes in those moments, his attitude ramps up dramatically and he tries to do a whole bunch of things that he's not supposed to do, but he's just seeing how far he can go and just how much he can get away with. And he'll keep doing that until I stand up. And I glare at him usually, and I point my finger at him and say, probably a little bit louder than this, "Teddy, that's enough." And at that point in time, Teddy knows that just about all bets are about ready to be off. All right? It's going to be safer for him to just kind of quietly go in another room and lay down rather than to stay with me because I'm angry with him and I'm about ready to lose it. And don't get me wrong, I'm not overly mean to my dog in any sort of way. He's very emotional and doesn't like to get in trouble, but he's learned very, very quickly what my signs of getting angry actually are. And that makes us all kind of think anger can be this incredibly powerful force in our lives, not just with our pets, but with each other, right? I love the way that anger was portrayed in the movie Inside Out as this little kind of red character who was a normal guy until suddenly something would set him off and he would start pounding his fist and he would jump up in the air and he would scream as loud as he could and his hair would turn to fire. How cool is that? I mean, that's totally how anger feels sometimes, isn't it? But here's the thing about anger. It doesn't matter who a person is. It doesn't matter what kind of moral authority that person subscribes to. When anger sets in, doing what's right becomes unappealing and irrelevant. And if you consider yourself a follower of Jesus today, and I know many of you here do, you can maybe even take that a little farther and say following the will of God becomes unappealing and irrelevant when anger kind of sets into our lives. Because when anger becomes part of the picture, we know this from experience, a person can crash through every single boundary there is, emotional or ethical or spiritual. It really doesn't matter when anger takes control. And for some of you here today, when you think back to your biggest regret in life, it is tied back to a moment when you let anger absolutely take control of your life. And the reason why we have moments like that is because we've all had this experience before where we are just overwhelmed with frustration or bitterness or any of the other kinds of emotions related with anger, and we get to a point where we just feel compelled to do something, right? It's like there's this pressure building up, there's this tension that needs to be released. We're unhappy, things aren't going the way that we want them to, and sometimes if that tension ramps up just enough, we will do anything to release it without stopping, without thinking, sometimes without considering ourselves or the people that we love. And we just kind of let anger loose. But let's be honest, right? I mean, come on, that never actually makes the situation better, does it? Oftentimes, it just makes the situation worse. Or it makes the situation more complicated, or it paves the way for a deeper and more significant regret in our lives. And yet, even though we all know that, even though we've all experienced anger in that way, every single one of us still struggles and does battle with anger on a daily basis. We all come across those moments where we have just had enough. And so the question becomes, what do we actually do when we've had enough? This whole entire summer, we've been going through the book of Numbers. No matter what campus you've been on, we've been digging deeper and deeper into the book of Numbers. And I hope that you've been able to see how the book of Numbers actually has applied to your daily life each and every week as we dig deeper. I know it doesn't seem like a book that would do that, but for me at least, it's been a significant book in that way. And I found that it speaks to this anger issue significantly too, especially when we come to Numbers chapter 20 that we've had today. But maybe you've noticed this as we've been reading through the book of Numbers. The book of Numbers can kind of build in a pattern that lulls us to sleep sooner or later. It seems like every single week when I go to prepare my sermon, Israel's complaining about something and God's punishing them, right? There's this constant pattern. Israel complains, God punishes. Israel complains, God punishes. Israel complains, God punishes. And it just seems after a little while like that's the way that it's supposed to be. Like every single time Israel complains, it is automatically wrong. It's a bad thing and God should punish them. And we've seen that all over the place this summer, right? There's that moment where Israel kind of complains in general and God sets a fire to the outskirts of their camp. And then they don't like the food that they're eating. Forget the fact that it's being rained down from heaven and it's the only thing in this whole entire barren wilderness. They get tired of it and they complain and God sends a plague into their camp. A little while later, it's like they forget that whole entire plague thing and they start complaining about food again, and because the plague didn't work, God sends snakes in this time. And then the people of Israel get to the border of the promised land and they decide that it's too big of a risk to go in. They're too afraid of the people that are there. And so they say no, and God condemns that generation to die in the wilderness. Again and again, we see this pattern, right? And those are just the ones that we've covered in sermons. If you've been reading through the book of Numbers, and some of you have on your own, you know that there's some stories that where it kind of even ramps up more past like PG-13 or even R-rated levels a little bit in the book of Numbers. If you've been reading along, you know that Miriam, Moses' sister, publicly questions Moses' leadership in a very negative way, and she's met with a skin disease. Along the way, there's this group of 250 men that set this coup up to overthrow Moses and Aaron and their leadership, and God causes the earth to open and swallow some of them, and he burns the rest with fire from heaven. Tell me that's not an intense moment. And then when the people of Israel begin to complain about losing some of their leaders, God sends a plague in again. It's rough, but we're almost primed to think that that's the way that it's supposed to be, right? Every time Israel complains, it seems like God should punish them because no complaint is legitimate. And yet, Numbers 20 tells us that that's not exactly the truth. And instead, we have to dig deeper and look at the actual heart of the issue to see why God responds to Israel the way that he does. You never know it when you start in Numbers chapter 20, because Numbers 20 seems like every other chapter almost in the book of Numbers. The sun comes up and the people of Israel are wandering around in the desert for another day, right? Just another part of the 40 years. And yet right away, the author of the book of Numbers notes that this situation, this time period is a little bit different. The author says there was no water for the people to drink at that place. Right away, a red flag should go up here. Right away, we should be a little bit nervous. Right away, we should notice that this is a serious situation. Yeah, the Israelites are complaining about everything that they possibly can. It's hot, there's sand all over the place, they don't get to eat any kinds of different foods or anything else like that. But none of that matters if they don't have water. Water is the basic essence of life for them in the midst of the wilderness. And so they get frustrated, they get upset, and they start to blame Moses and Aaron for everything that's going on. And this one makes sense out of all the complaints, doesn't it? Basic science should tell us that a human being can only last about 3 days without having water. This is a really serious situation for the people of Israel. This is not just another complaint to God of, God, we don't like your blessing, you need to give us something better. It's close to becoming a life or death issue for the people of Israel. And they react the way that they do because their backs are up against a wall. And I love the way that Numbers says that the people are almost complaining at Moses and Aaron to the point where they have to run away to get into the tabernacle. The noises are still outside the tent as Moses and Aaron go in to talk to God about it. But notice some things that are missing from some of those other stories. When Moses and Aaron go in to talk to God, God's not really upset, is he? We never read the line that God looked at Moses and Aaron and said, "Why are the people complaining against me?" That doesn't ever exist. Instead, God's heart goes out to his people in compassion. He shows them love in a pretty incredible way. He seems to realize just how desperate, just how dire the situation is. As a matter of fact, it's one of the shortest conversations between God and Moses and Aaron there is in the whole entire book of Numbers. Right away, God sets forth a plan for Moses and Aaron. He says, you and Aaron must take the staff. That's the staff that Moses lifted to part the Red Sea. He said, and assemble the entire community. As the people watch, speak to the rock over there, however big the rock was, and it will pour out its water. You will provide enough water from the rock to satisfy the whole community and their livestock. And we read this and go, good. There's a solution. There's not going to be a lot of tension in this story. God's going to do something amazing. We're going to witness something incredible. Moses and Aaron begin to bring the people towards the rock. Moses has the staff in his hand. We're all primed to see this amazing, miraculous act by God. And then everything changes like that. Because Moses opens his mouth and nothing but pure anger comes out. Numbers says that Moses turns to the people of Israel and screams at them and says, listen, you rebels, must we bring you water from this rock? Moses reaches his breaking point. He's had enough. He's had enough of the desert. He's had enough of the complaining. He's had enough of these pesky Israelites that won't move and don't do anything that you want them to do. He is absolutely and totally frustrated. And in his anger, not only does he yell at the people of Israel, but he completely disobeys God. He takes the staff that God had told him to take, and instead of calling out to the rock, he slaps the rock twice with the staff. Because all he knew was that there was such a tension in his life that he had to do something, anything, to relieve it. And for some of us, that should make sense. Maybe even for all of us, Moses' reaction should make sense. If you've ever had to lead a group of people before, you know exactly how this can be. Now, immediately, as a leader, your life becomes a fishbowl. Everybody can look in on you. Everyone can share an opinion with you. Everyone can critique you, even when things are going well. But when things start going poorly, how much fun is it to be a leader in a fishbowl? It is not at all. People get frustrated. All you need to do is watch an NFL team doing poorly to see how this works. Vikings fans, we know this very, very well, okay? People get frustrated. When things start to go downhill fast, people get angry. All of a sudden, everybody has an opinion on what should be done. Everybody is frustrated. They have a bunch of anger that is all pointed at the one individual who can't get their act together. And that is exactly where Moses and Aaron were with the people of Israel. But on the other hand, we have to see how destructive their attitude actually is. I mean, Moses and Aaron, they blatantly sin against God. And don't get me wrong, it's not good that they, you know, hammer the rock with a staff, but it goes much deeper than that. Moses talks to the people of God and calls them rebels. That's an intense insult for the people of God, especially in that day and age. Immediately when he does that, he gives into his anger, and it's no longer Moses seeing himself as someone called out by the grace of God to lead God's people in grace. Instead, he draws a line of distinction. He's better now than the people of Israel. He's now the judge of the people of Israel. And he goes even further. He says, must we bring you water out of this rock? Moses and Aaron set themselves up to be the deliverers of the people of Israel. Notice who's missing in all of this. God. He's nowhere to be found. Moses and Aaron make it all about themselves as they give into anger because they're so incredibly bitter with the people of Israel. And right away in this story, there's something that we cannot miss. If you've maybe tuned out for a second, come back and check this. Every single time when we get close to giving into anger, every single time when we're about ready to like just have had enough and let anger rule and control our lives for a moment, there is bound to be something that we are missing in the bigger picture. There's bound to be, because by nature, anger blinds us from seeing grace. It blinds us from seeing goodness. That's exactly where Moses and Aaron were that day. God was ready to show compassion. God was ready to show mercy and grace to his people, but Moses and Aaron wanted nothing to do with it. The complaining had made them self-righteous. Their compassion went out the door, and the only thing that they wanted for the people of Israel was absolute wrath. But what they really needed was a second opinion. Right? What they really needed was someone to come in and know where they were at and understand the frustrations and the struggles of leadership, but also to say, look what you're missing. Look what God's doing in the midst of this. And when we get angry and we want to let anger rule our lives, we need the exact same thing. When we're about ready to lose it, if we can possibly do it, we should find someone who can be as objective as possible to look at the situation, to help us see the things that we might be missing, because by nature, anger blinds us from seeing the reality of God's grace in our lives. And that's exactly where Moses and Aaron were. But instead of leaning on somebody else, they leaned into anger. And they found out pretty quickly something that I'm sure all of us know, but read this one with me. Anger always has consequences. One more time. Anger always has consequences. It does. And it's not just that Moses and Aaron, like I said, it's not just that they beat the rock instead of talking to the rock. Is that they blatantly break off from actually trusting in God. They make themselves out to be gods for the people of Israel instead. They're the ones that are suddenly giving the water. That's a first commandment level offense done by the guy who got the commandments from God on the mountain. And there's consequences for that. And so after everything kind of tunes down for a minute, God calls Moses and Aaron aside, and really he just shares one sentence with them. He says, you will not lead Israel into the land I'm giving them. Now, I don't know how Moses and Aaron reacted right away to this, but I'm positive that at some point in time, their lives were filled and flooded with regret. Because that's the way that anger works. We know this. You give into anger in a major way, and it maybe feels good for 5 minutes or 10 minutes or maybe even a whole entire day, but sooner or later, you open your eyes and realize that you have a whole entire mess on your hands. And sometimes we try to justify it to get away from seeing the mess. We appeal to, well, it was that person's fault, or that server didn't do what I wanted them to do, or maybe we just appeal to our standing. I'm the parent, or I'm the boss, or I'm the pastor. But when we really sit down and think about it, we see that our anger has created a bunch of broken pieces that maybe not even we know how to put back together. Because that's what anger does. And yet, even in the midst of that, I feel like I've said this so many times this summer, and I'm not saying it because I don't have anything else to say. I'm saying it because it's absolutely true. The amazing thing in Numbers is that the story doesn't end there. God lets his compassion have the final word instead. In the last little bit and in the chapters forward, we see God stretching out, reaching out to grasp Moses and Aaron and pull them back to him, grasping even Israel and pulling them back to him. He's showing grace again and again and again. I mean, realize this. This situation is not even remotely good. Moses and Aaron, these upstanding leaders of the people of God, have said all of the wrong things and done all of the wrong stuff. And yet God still performs a miracle in the desert. Water still shoots out of that rock. And the people of Israel that are thirsty come and drink and have their fill, not just them, but their children, not just their children, but their animals and their livestock. And Moses and Aaron. You see, God doesn't act like nothing ever happened. God never does that. But in the midst of this angry situation, he doesn't let anger have the final word. He instead lets his grace reign. He doesn't cut off Moses and Aaron from the people of Israel. Otherwise, he would send them out into the wilderness, and he doesn't do that. Instead, he invites them to see that in the midst of their consequences that they'll receive, the enduring truth that will prevail through it all is that God and his love had not stopped for them. God invited them to see through his action, through his sacrifice, through his forgiveness, Moses and Aaron still did have a place in the family of God, and he was extending his hand, inviting them to leave their anger behind, to draw to him as the rock of their life and to drink of his grace. Much like the Israelites drank from that rock in the wilderness that day until they were satisfied. And you know what? It's the same way for you and for me. Even though you may struggle with anger, and let's be honest, we all do at some point in time. Even if you can look back at your life or even your last week and see the consequences pile up or the messes that have been created or have been there for years and years and years, the prevailing truth through it all is that you are not disqualified from being loved by God. You're not. You are never too far to be outside of the reach of God's grace. You never get to a point where God is going to stop chasing after you because you've gone too far. Instead, through it all, God invites you and me through his son, Jesus, to do exactly what he invited Moses and Aaron to do, to leave our anger behind, to draw to him as the rock of our life and to drink of his grace and let that sustain our lives. And you know why I say that? I say that because thousands of years after this event in the wilderness, this carpenter from Nazareth named Jesus, who proclaimed himself to be the Messiah, the Son of God, would come on the scene. And in a situation that seemed very similar, he would stand over a bunch of Israelites at this big feast that was there, just like Moses stood up before Israel in the desert. And Jesus would stand up and shout something, just like Moses shouted something that day. But his message would be completely and totally different. Instead of calling the people there rebels, people who couldn't stand up to God's perfect law, Jesus said, "Anyone who is thirsty may come to me." Anyone. No matter their past, background, nationality, life story, struggle with anger. Jesus says, anyone who is thirsty may come to me. Anyone who believes in me may come and drink. For the scriptures declare rivers of living water will flow from his heart. See what he did? He set himself up to be the rock in the middle of the wilderness. He set himself up to be the one who would give everything for the benefit of other people. And he did, just like that rock was struck in the desert unnecessarily, the Son of God was struck and nailed to a cross where he gave up his life for the anyone's. And he does it to show us how he comes and meets us, to freely bring his grace to all who come to him thirsty. He comes to bring forgiveness. He comes to bring newness. He comes to bring belonging in the family of God, belonging that we can't get anywhere else. And when we drink of the grace of God, it acts like a living water that sustains us as we go through life. We see anger all over the place today. You have to be living under a rock for the last couple of weeks to not see anger all over the place. But you want to know the big difference between God's grace and anger? When we drink of the grace of God, it actually does the opposite. Because the focus is not on us, it's on the grace that we receive from the Son of God. Instead of dividing, it unites. Instead of tearing us down, it reminds us that every single person matters to our Heavenly Father. Instead of superiority, it calls us to bring healing and to see healing everywhere that we go. Because the reality that Jesus Christ came to bring is that in Him you can know that you are loved. In Him you can know that you have been brought grace beyond measure. And in Him you can know that the invitation is free. Anyone who is thirsty may come to me and drink, and I will transform their lives. Amen?